Can we end epidemics? It may seem like wishful thinking with the receding COVID-19 pandemic so fresh in our minds, but scientists have managed to beat back and even eradicate many contagious diseases over time. In the new book, Ending Epidemics, A History of Escape from Contagion, Richard Conniff shares the fascinating story of this ongoing battle. Richard is a National Magazine Award-winning writer for Smithsonian Magazine, The Atlantic, National Geographic, and other publications, and has written multiple books. Here he is to share five of his big ideas.
My name is Richard Conniff, and I wrote my new book, Ending Epidemics, because looking back over my own life, what struck me is that so many of us born since World War II have lived protected lives. Protected, that is, from infectious disease. That may seem hard to accept with people still dying from COVID and the HIV/AIDS pandemics, but major diseases that killed and maimed us for much of human history, including smallpox, measles, whooping cough, diphtheria, and polio, have largely vanished from our lives, here and in the developing world, too. The story of this revolution in public health took hold of me, and I'd like to share five big insights that developed as I dug into the research. The first insight is that it's a personal story for all of us. And the trouble is, we take it entirely for granted. Just ask an uncle or grandmother what kind of childhood diseases they grew up with. In my family, for instance, my father and my uncle both had polio as toddlers in the 1920s. My uncle got it worse, with legs that were permanently reduced to sticks. He got around for the rest of his life on arm braces. Summer was still polio season when I was a toddler. One year then, polio killed more than 3,100 people in this country and paralyzed 21,000. But in 1955, Jonas Salk's polio vaccine became available, and people flocked to get it. I was one of them. Polio season became summer again. Progress against infectious disease accelerated from there, so it's not just that my own kids avoided almost all the childhood diseases that were routine for me. A major international effort also began knocking down childhood diseases everywhere, with polio, for instance, eliminated from all but two nations by 2019. And now kids my grandson's age are being protected against diseases most parents never heard of, like rotavirus, which used to routinely kill small children. Think about that. If you had told someone 150 years ago, when my great-grandparents were alive, that human ingenuity and effort could eradicate smallpox everywhere, forever, and largely eliminate a murderer's row of childhood diseases in much of the world, they would have said it couldn't be done. If you had told them that improvements in public health would double the average human life expectancy everywhere in less than a century, they would have laughed and said that couldn't be done either. And yet it happened. It has been the single most dramatic change in all of human history, but to say it happened within living memory is wrong. It is the catch-22 of vaccines, antibiotics, and all infectious disease prevention measures. They save us from diseases, then cause us to forget the diseases from which they have saved us. Our sense of freedom from all the diseases that haunted our parents and grandparents has given us the bizarre sense that we are somehow naturally immune and no longer need to take even the most basic precautions. So I wrote this book to remind people, because we need to know how incredibly far we have come to have a chance at facing down the epidemics that still lie ahead. Here's insight number two. Medical discovery isn't just a story about a few big names. Let's start with one of the biggest. Jonas Salk was practically a saint when I was a kid. In fact, I still have my vaccination certificate from that first year of the Salk vaccine. My parents kept it in a folder of sacred documents together with my baptismal certificate. But no great discovery is ever the unaided work of a lone genius or wholly original. New ideas don't just spring out of nowhere and instantly change everything. They almost always result from a collaboration among many researchers, and most of their names get left out of the story. Isabel Morgan, for instance, faced predictable challenges in the mid-20th century workplace. The director of one institute where she worked described her as a brilliant young virologist and also a very handsome-looking girl. And he added, "It's just that I don't think that she could have advanced very far at the institute. Few PhD ladies ever had much of a chance for advancement at the institute during the early days." Morgan moved on to Johns Hopkins University, and by 1951, she had developed a formalin-inactivated polio vaccine, the prototype of the Salk vaccine, and she demonstrated that she could immunize experimental monkeys against all three types of poliovirus, everything needed to prevent polio, except testing in humans. But Morgan stopped there, maybe because she had married and married women back then weren't supposed to work, or because she chose to care for a stepson with a learning disability, or maybe she shrank from the risky business of testing on human children. The March of Dimes, which paid for most polio research, was soon betting its money on Jonas Salk, and all the glory followed. So maybe we shouldn't call it the Salk vaccine, nor the Morgan vaccine either, because that's not how science works. Every great breakthrough builds on the prior work of countless other women and men. Here's insight number three. The fight against infectious disease isn't only about great medical discoveries. One of my favorite characters in Ending Epidemics was a social reformer named Edwin Chadwick. He campaigned aggressively in the 1840s and 50s for the British government to intervene in matters of public health. Chadwick wanted centralized systems of public water supply and sewerage, and that work laid down the blueprint for making large modern cities livable, not just in Britain, but by example, worldwide. So how did he succeed? By undertaking a massive exploration of the lives of the urban poor. Then he explained what he saw in vivid detail to readers for whom the world just around the corner was as alien as the slums of Calcutta. His 1842 sanitary report from the government's own stationery office has been called a masterpiece of protest literature. It sold 100,000 copies. Politicians balked at first. London's mayor declared that there could be no improvement of the water supply system because it was already perfect. 2 years later, cholera hit, and delivered through that same water system, it killed 15,000 London residents. Chadwick's work ultimately led city governments in London and beyond to build municipal water supply systems and safer sewerage. By limiting the spread of cholera, typhoid, polio, and other waterborne diseases, those systems have saved lives and increased life expectancy everywhere they exist. Extending the kind of sanitary reforms Edwin Chadwick pioneered throughout developing world cities is still probably the single most important thing we could do to improve public health. Here's insight number four. All vaccines involve risks and also benefits. For instance, the vaccine for HPV can sometimes cause pain where the shot was given. Fever, dizziness, and nausea can also occur. That's the risk side of the story. These effects are almost always temporary. But misinformation about risk caused uptake of the vaccine in Japan to drop from 70% in 2013 to just 1%, almost overnight. The scare didn't spread to the United States, and a study this year found that for American women in their 20s, the HPV vaccine produced a 65% decline in cervical cancers. That's the benefit side of the story. In this country, plenty of parents worry about the MMR vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella. Part of the problem is that they never see measles anymore, and they imagine that it is a minor disease. It isn't. I had measles in 1958, before a vaccine existed. I had it so bad my parents thought I was going to die, and 552 other American kids with measles did die that year. That's in addition to the 1 in 1,000 measles victims who suffer from encephalitis, often resulting in permanent hearing loss or intellectual disability. 1 in 20 suffer pneumonia, the leading cause of measles deaths. And yet, what parents worry about is an imaginary link between the MMR vaccine and autism, a link invented by a doctor working on a lawsuit against vaccine manufacturers, a link that's been repeatedly disproved, most recently in a study of more than 600,000 children. Like every other vaccine, the MMR vaccine does have risks. They can include febrile seizures, which sound bad, but that's rare and typically without lasting effect. So how should parents think about a risk like that? Being a good parent isn't about protecting children from every possible risk. It's about making a judgment with advice from a doctor about relative risk. Because so many parents made the wrong choice about risk, almost 1,300 American children came down with measles in 2019. About 130 of them needed hospitalization, and 64 of them suffered complications, including pneumonia and encephalitis. And this was just two decades after public health officials proudly declared measles eliminated from North America. Here's insight number five. When it comes to preventing epidemics, history matters. And some of the best lessons come from a public health effort that began almost by accident in 1966. That's when the WHO, the World Health Organization, launched a campaign to eradicate smallpox worldwide. It was a wildly ambitious, ill-planned, and probably unreachable goal, and they meant to get it done in just 10 years. But as the campaign got started in Brazil and Indonesia, that global ambition lit a fire under public health workers. Both countries soon freed themselves from this genuinely horrible disease. Then, experienced workers from those countries went on to help other countries and to trade methods for tracking down smallpox cases anywhere. They became part of a multinational army of public health workers, armed with the simplest technologies, a smallpox vaccine not so different from the one first developed in the 18th century, and a bifurcated needle that had no moving parts. It wasn't just a story of international cooperation, but also of heroic individual effort. Teams of vaccinators traveled in floods, droughts, famine, and civil war. There were no cell phones to call for help in emergencies, which were a daily routine. In Ethiopia, a helicopter pilot was kidnapped by rebels. He took the opportunity to vaccinate his captors. Public health workers finally cornered the last known case of naturally acquired smallpox in Mogadishu in October 1977. The WHO campaign had missed its goal to eradicate smallpox in 10 years, but just barely. An astonished observer remarked, "The workers in the campaign were simply too young to know it couldn't be done." So what's the lesson we should take from that history? Well, the lesson the WHO took away was that vaccines work. It went on to increase uptake of six basic childhood vaccines from just 5% in the 1980s to 86% or better in almost all nations by 2019, with a corresponding decline in disease. We could expand that now to bring basic medical care, safe drinking water, and sanitation to the billions who lack these necessities for human health. We could eradicate other notorious diseases like polio and measles. The world has become too small, and it moves too fast for us to waste time fighting one another. We need to accept that infectious diseases anywhere are now infectious diseases for all of us. Working together to stop them is the only way to protect ourselves from the epidemics that still lie ahead.
Thank you, Richard. That was Richard Conniff with five big ideas from Ending Epidemics, A History of Escape from Contagion. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.